Welcome to Target Cancer Podcast. My name is Dr. Sanjay Janeja. I'm a hematologist and medical oncologist, also known as the OncDoc on social media. And today we have a topic that a lot of people are interested in and possibly not interested in, because we've heard about vaccines and we've heard about things for years and decades. We're all familiar with, you know, the COVID era, but there are some very inarguable, exciting things coming out when it relates to vaccines, both preventative and actually treating. And today our guest knows all about that stuff. He has more degrees than a thermometer. It is Dr. David Braun, who is at Yale currently, was at Dana-Farber previously, is kind of a wizard when it comes to molecular and precision stuff. And I am super excited to talk about these kind of therapies that a lot of people want deviated away from the cytotoxic, you know, poison chemo things, and kind of really go back to the basics, which is our immune system and their surveillance system and the stuff that's really kept us alive and well, you know, for many of our years. It's kind of back to the basics after overcomplicating, arguably. So with all that said, David, we're super excited to have you, and thank you for being here.
No, thank you so much for having me as well. I'm really excited to be on and to be able to chat.
Yeah, they always say, you know, I'm sure for years, oh, oncology is moving so fast, it's exciting, et cetera. But I really think it's specifically more, you know, that than it's ever been. And that's because of all these different things we've discovered in treatments that kind of deviate away again from, you know, chemos and stuff we've used for decades that are very effective, but also because we're able to understand, evaluate, and assess cancers in a way we haven't been able to for decades. And that's when you're talking about, you know, molecular and a bunch of things that have to do at a much deeper level than just looking at tissue under a microscope. And it seems like that is your core passion, is let's rethink everything because we're looking at everything in a way we never knew before.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think for a long time, cancer therapy was in an era of empiricism. And that's not a bad thing, right? Empiricism, trying things, optimizing, that's really important. If we think about a lot of the advances that were made, you know, we think of success stories like the treatment of pediatric leukemias. That was a lot of iterations, trying different things, optimizing sequencing and all of these sorts of things. Really, really helpful. But I think what's changed in the last really couple decades is this idea of having a mechanistic understanding of the disease. And if we can understand the biology of the cancer, we can understand how it interacts with the immune system, then we can, I think, begin to rationally think about how to design these optimal therapies. And that's, yeah, immunology is complicated. I think the more we know, the more we realize we're still in the dark. And so we're going to have a lot of misses too. But I think it gives us really, for the first time, we have the toolkit to really dissect out how these tumors work, and use that knowledge to try to be a little bit smarter with how we design future therapies.
For sure. And I think, you know, when it relates to kidney cancer specifically, which is one of your areas of deepest expertise, as well as usually melanomas, we think about these where we've kind of, you know, pulled back the layers a little bit to appreciate how the immune system can really help our control on these cancer types. So can you tell me what, you know, is the exciting stuff that you get excited about and really what we learned and how we hacked the immune system for renal cell or kidney cancer specifically, and what we're doing now and kind of maybe what we're thinking about doing in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So kidney cancer has this really interesting kind of history with the immune system. You go back, you know, 100 plus years, and there are these reports actually from the originators of the Mayo Clinic. Charles H. Mayo has a report of taking out the primary kidney tumor and seeing lung metastases that disappeared. So there's always this interesting sort of association for 100 plus years with kidney cancer and the immune system. But really, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s is really when I think we really start to see the power of how the immune system can not just interact with kidney cancer, but be leveraged to treat it. And that was with some of these initial immune therapies. They don't have a lot of steam today, but back in the 90s, there's not much else that we could use to treat kidney cancer. And those were cytokine-based therapies, particularly high-dose IL-2. And when I think of, you know, how to modulate the immune system, how to really leverage it for therapeutic use, I think of sort of three main branches, three things that we are able to do. We can push on the gas pedal of the immune system and really try to make it go. We can lift up the brakes of the immune system, and that's what a lot of the things we use today are. And then the last part is we can try to add a steering wheel, give it a little specificity, and we can talk certainly about how we're trying to do that in the field. But the first tool was just pressing hard on the gas pedal, and that was high-dose IL-2. And it was a brutal therapy. You know, people had to be in the intensive care unit to get it. They were really set when they were receiving it. But I've met patients at kidney cancer conferences, patient advocacy events, where they had metastatic kidney cancer, something that was almost uniformly deadly in the 90s. You know, average life expectancy was probably around a year with metastatic kidney cancer. And here they are 20, 25 years later, alive and free of disease because they got high-dose IL-2. Now, that wasn't the norm. That was the exception. That was, you know, maybe 5%, 5 or 7%. But it was like the really first proof of concept that the immune system could be used in an incredibly powerful way to not just treat, but in some patients, potentially even cure a metastatic solid tumor like kidney cancer. And then fast forward to where we are today, and now we talk about that second lever, releasing the brakes with immune checkpoint inhibitors. And that's really just transformed how we treat metastatic advanced kidney cancer. The, you know, the first thing that a patient's going to get if they have metastatic disease is going to be a therapeutic regimen that contains one of these immune checkpoint inhibitors. So that blocks the PD-1 blockade, unleashes the T cells to do their job. And again, it's not that everyone gets tremendous benefit. There's still a ton of room to do better. But even in the last 5 years, the way that has transformed how kidney cancer is treated, how long patients are living, some patients really live like a long time, it really is another kind of proof of concept that the immune system can be used in really clever ways to not just attack kidney cancer, but really actually keep it control or even get rid of it for long periods of time.
I love the way you put that, like the gas, which is when we gave basically a signal that happens with fevers and all that stuff, you just basically cause calamity with the signal. And you see that exact process, but like on steroids, literally, not literally, but you know, the swelling and all this stuff. And yeah, 6 to 8% forever. And the guidelines were like, yo, you can still do this because things might disappear. And now it's a little, you know, much more forgiving with immune therapy. So before we talk about maybe what makes kidney cancer and plus minus melanoma specifically sensitive to getting off the brakes, this is a concept that if you can speak on, a lot of people commonly and reasonably ask, if I take off the head of Medusa of sorts, then the other things that have metastasized may improve, right? And, you know, then you kind of talk about how things have really just cloned. So it's as if your, you know, triplets or quadruplets that you had moved to different parts of the country, they're still like, you know, different. And what happened to the household they grew up in doesn't really affect them if they moved away. But to that same concept, is that still a thing when it comes to renal cell, where if you do cut out the primary tumor, you see these other spots go away? And is that something that's unique to kidney cancer? And if so, do you know why? And how come that's not the case for other things?
Yeah. You know, I think the real answer is we really don't know. And there's really interesting conflicting data. And so we have all these anecdotes and they're really appealing because we hear these stories. And again, we go back 100 years, Charles H. Mayo, we have this taking out the kidney tumor and the main primary tumor and the rest regress. We have, you know, evidence later on, someone got radiation to one site and all of a sudden the rest goes away. That's so called abscopal effect, which we, you know, unfortunately see incredibly, incredibly rarely. And there's even some case reports, if you scour the literature, of people getting a COVID vaccine and their kidney cancer regressing after that. Not common, but certainly case reports. And it makes me think back again to about 100 years ago to Cooley's toxins, the surgeon at Memorial Hospital, who really one of the parent figures in immunotherapy, who'd give patients, fly by the term, bacterial sepsis. They would give them the toxins from you know, strep and other bacteria. And the thought was if you could just mount a general immune response, that might be enough to wake things up and in that his case sort of attack sarcoma. And so, you know, there's surely this idea for a long time in kidney cancer that maybe you can hit the primary, take out that primary tumor, and for various reasons, including it might just be suppressing the body's kind of really ability to fight things off, really kind of globally suppressing the immune system, that maybe taking out the primary will be helpful. And it was anecdotes for a while. And then about 24, 25 years ago now, there was an actual study where people looked at it very rigorously, a randomized trial of looking at patients who received just a cytokine, in this case interferon, versus a cytokine, and they surgically removed the kidney. And it wasn't just that, you know, there was a less tumor, that's sort of obvious. but people actually lived longer. The overall survival was improved by taking out that primary tumor. And so that was really, really interesting and became largely the standard, what was called cytoreductive nephrectomy, the idea of taking out the primary even when you have metastatic disease. And that is not common among solid tumors. That is really, I think, something unique to kidney. I think things became a little bit more nuanced as time went on. And so, you know, if you move later on, there's actually a really amazing effort from the French group, which conducted this trial over basically the course of a decade, because I think patients, and this is very understandable, if there's an opportunity to, I have a big tumor in my kidney, it's a 10 centimeter tumor, even if I have spots elsewhere, I want to get that thing out. I want to have it cut out. And so that's really a powerful, powerful force. So it, you know, the French group really wanted to study this. I think had a hard, probably a hard time actually convincing people to not get the surgery as part of this trial. But what they did is, when we had a sort of more modern therapy compared to the cytokines, which was targeted therapy, this era of targeted therapy where it would block new blood vessel formation, these anti-angiogenic drugs, in that sort of more modern era, that era started around 2005, 2006, did still make sense to cut out the kidney. And this French group, they worked for a decade on this. And the answer in that setting was probably not. There's some nuances about the clinical trial and the setting and all these sorts of things. But, you know, big New England Journal article, this Carmina trial did not show an advantage to taking out the primary. And so people sort of went back and said, maybe we were sort of misled all along. Maybe it was just, we didn't have effective therapies for kidney cancer. So just doing a big surgery is better than doing nothing at all. And sort of fell out of favor. I think now we've gone back to immune therapies with these anti-PD-1 drugs, these immune checkpoint inhibitors. And now I think there's an idea that it has to be selected carefully, but particular patients might actually benefit from this. Then maybe the tumor is actually suppressing things in a way. And, you know, there's little pieces of evidence. People have done these retrospective studies where they look back and see the people who got their primary kidney out actually looked like they did better than those that didn't. That's fairly biased. It's retrospective. But even if you look at some of our clinical trials, we look at the landmark clinical trial that got immunotherapy approved as it is today in kidney cancer, this CheckMate 214 trial. When they look back, every single patient who had a complete response in that trial, they also had their kidney removed surgically. And so I think in practice, we do it sometimes. It's not that every patient that walks in the door, but there's a select group of patients where they have a big, big kidney mass, very little disease outside. You know, that's a situation. We might take out the kidney. Another one is someone's doing great on therapy. They start on medicines. They start on immune therapy. Everything's shrinking, and now it's the big kidney mass that's left, taking it out afterwards. And so it's sort of done anecdotally. A lot of people in the kidney cancer community do it. But like anything else, it needs to be rigorously studied now. So now we're in a situation where there's enough buy-in where multiple large groups are running big clinical trials to try to explore this, to say, okay, in the modern era where we have good immune therapies, should we still take out that primary tumor? So there's a group that's saying, let's have a randomized trial and either take out the primary tumor or not and see how patients do. That's the PROBE study, a really good, powerful study. And there's an emerging role for radiation in kidney cancer as well. And obviously that's much less invasive to give a targeted radiation rather than, you know, pretty big surgery. And so there's a group, the Samurai trial, that is looking at, well, for patients who have metastatic disease, what if we radiate that primary tumor in addition to immune therapy? Does that help at all? So, you know, today it's controversial. We don't know, but hopefully with these really good clinical trial efforts, you know, 3-4 years down the line, we'll have a real answer to that.
So because we can't necessarily explain why that may be the case, and because it's so unique, and I think you had kind of alluded to that, is there the possibility that the inflammation and rev up of the surgery itself with the scalpel, you know, may kind of inflame or incite these immune cells that kill it in other places? And I think if you were to look at the ones where maybe you are doing radiation or avoiding a scalpel and injury to these blood vessels that then release these, you know, signals in a, you know, small way, similar to what we kind of fueled it with before, then maybe, you know, if it's not as evident with radiation or burning the, you know, blood supply with something called TACE or embolization, where you cut off the supply. I'm just curious, you know, where that goes. And mostly because you always have to raise an eyebrow on why something may be the case somewhere and not somewhere else. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and I think time will tell. I think there's so many possibilities where, you know, is it just having a lot of tumor and that's tough to shrink, so taking it out is going to be helpful, or radiating it? Is it that it's, you know, as you're saying, the inflammation itself from surgery? It's kind of like the old Coley's toxin, just giving some nonspecific inflammation, that's going to kind of rev things up enough. The other possibility is, you know, the tumor is actually producing something that just makes the immune system work less well. And I think that's probably true to some extent, at least. And I think we sort of even know this. It's a little bit, you know, it's extrapolating, but we know patients, goes back, Tony Schwerin had worked on this and others. In the beginning of the COVID era, they really looked at how patients with solid tumors did when they got COVID. And unfortunately, they did a lot worse. They, you know, they more likely had severe COVID, you know, more likely have death from COVID. And I think there is this kind of global immune suppression that can happen when you have a big bulky tumor. And so sometimes cutting it out might relieve that to some extent. So I think a lot of interesting kind of mechanism that's possible. But I think the big thing is, just for patients, does it work clinically? And that's why I think these trials are going to explore that and are going to be really helpful.
100%. Now, this is the part that I'm really eager to sink my teeth into. Please tell us about the whole vaccination kind of discovery and thought, and how, you know, I guess it's not too hard to conceive, because we know we have quote unquote actionable targets and proteins that, you know, some consider precision medicine. It is precision medicine, but there's more to it. And so we're excited about all of these things. So it's not inconceivable that the same thing you are acting on as an actual mutation or therapy, that you could quote unquote vaccinate against it, which basically gives a wanted poster to your immune system or lymphocytes and says, yo, go find this thing. The problem is, a lot of times there are mutations or properties of a target that we see on other cells that are our normal cells. So we don't want our body, you know, causing an autoimmune disease of sorts, because, you know, what if it's expressed on something else, like HER2 positivity and heart failure that started, you know, when we would give that and all of those things. What are we doing with kidney vaccines and kidney cancer that's making it, one, safe and not autoimmune, but also potentially effective?
No, this is, you know, it's a field that's really developing, and is, I think, one of the most exciting things that's in the coming years. And so it sort of boils down to, you give an immune therapy drug, one of the ones we have, and let's say everything goes right. It's a perfect situation where someone has this incredible response. The cancer disappears from the body. You really, you know, fall year after year. You can't see it come back. What is it that the immune system's actually recognizing? What is it seeing on those cancer cells that's so appealing, that's so, you know, so clearly foreign to the immune system, that recognizes it, says we have to get rid of it and clears it? And those are the antigens. Those are what the immune system, and specifically T cells, are able to recognize. They're called antigens. And our immune system is really exquisitely well-trained to recognize antigens that are foreign and to try to get rid of them, and to also recognize when antigens are not foreign, when they're part of our cells, and to leave those alone. And that makes a ton of sense, because that's how our immune system evolved, right? If we think of what were kind of the evolutionary pressure on the immune system, frankly, it's not cancer, because people didn't live long enough, you know, a few hundred years ago to get cancer. The main thing was fighting off viruses and fighting off pathogens. And this is really one of the main ways that the immune system does it, that, you know, the T cells, they go around the body and they check each cell and they say, is this part of our cell or not? And if it's part of our cells, it says, okay, we're good, we're going to leave this cell alone. But if that cell has a virus that's in it, it's infected by a virus, all of a sudden that virus-infected cell is presenting something that's foreign, an antigen that's new to the immune system, and the immune system recognizes and says, this shouldn't be here, and attacks it and clears it. And so that's the whole principle of how immunity has evolved to fight viruses, and very much the idea behind how the immune system, and specifically T cells, really are effective against cancer. The question has been, what are those antigens? What are those targets on the tumor cells? Which are the good ones, and how can we leverage that to actually make effective therapies? And so it's been a long, long process. And the idea of targeting those antigens with a vaccine has been around actually for decades now. But I think it's about selecting the right target. And I should also clarify, when we talk about vaccines, I think most people's minds naturally goes to preventive vaccines, prophylactic vaccines, the kind we get for infectious diseases like COVID. You get a vaccine with the hope that you don't get COVID, or if you get it, you'll get a milder form. For cancer, it's less about the preventive vaccines. I mean, separately talk about that. But a lot of what we're thinking of now is therapeutic vaccines. So someone has cancer, how can we give a vaccine that, as you said, sort of puts a wanted poster up and says, immune system, go and target these things specifically, these tumors specifically. And that's the idea of therapeutic vaccines. And it has two decades of unfortunately having excitement but disappointing clinical results. And I think things hopefully are just beginning to change. And it's about narrowing in on exactly what that target is, what that antigen is. And so for a while, our tools to study that were pretty limited. And so what people would select are things that are still present in normal parts of the body often, but they're higher in cancer cells. They're at an increased level. And the hope was maybe if they're at an increased level on cancer cells, then the immune system, we can use that as a target, we can vaccinate, and the immune system will attack it. But again, the immune system is really good at distinguishing self and not self. So even if something's really, really at a high level on a cancer cell, if it's still there on normal cells, the immune system is well trained to say, this is part of ourselves. I'm going to leave this alone. And so that was really, I think, a challenge for decades, really, in terms of the cancer vaccine field. What's changed is our ability to do individualized sequencing, to understand for an individual patient, for their tumor, what are the mutations they have. That's important to figure out what's driving the cancer. But there's a lot of mutations that are just along for the ride. They're passengers. They're just cancers. They replicate a lot. They make a lot of mutations, a lot of DNA errors. And so those cancer cells carry a ton of mutations. And each time the DNA is changed, each time it has one of those mutations, that's the potential for a new target, a new antigen to be formed. And that's the name for that is a neoantigen. Neoantigen literally just means a new antigen that forms from one of the mutations. And what's really, I think, special about neoantigens is those are really foreign to the body. Those are not something that's just, you know, at a higher level on a cancer cell and lower level in normal parts of the body. Normal parts of the body don't have that mutation at all. So this is something that's truly cancer specific and really makes something an ideal target for the development of a therapeutic vaccine. And so that was a lot of excitement, a lot of theory, but really over the last 5 to 8 years, we've started to see that enter the clinic. First, it was proof of concept. Can we actually do this? It's not an easy thing to do. You have to, for each patient in this case, sequence their tumor, sequence normal parts of the blood, try to figure out what mutations that patient has that's totally unique to them, and then custom make a therapy, right? This is not something like a standard drug that you take off the shelf. You have to custom make a therapy. So is that even possible to do in the context of cancer therapy? We have to move pretty quickly. And that was the first challenge. And really starting in 2017, that's when people really start to show, you can do this in real time. You can do it safely. People do pretty well with it. And I think one of those reasons are, we talked again about those sort of different levers on the immune system, the gas pedal, the brakes, and the steering wheel. When you press on the gas pedal, you're not telling the immune system to attack cancer and not normal. You're just pressing the gas and say when you're releasing the brakes. But when you're giving a vaccine, you're really giving it the steering wheel. You're really saying, go specifically to something that's in the cancer and ignore the regular parts of the body. And so the concept behind that is it's going to hopefully be more effective and less toxic. And it's early, but I think we're actually we're seeing some of those hopes beginning at least to bear out in terms of safety. And so, proof of concept initially, now we're starting to move into a phase where it's, I think, getting a lot more exciting, where larger number of patients are being treated. And we're seeing not just proof of concept, but actually some clinical effects. And there's been a couple studies recently, one in melanoma, aggressive skin cancer, one in a really hard to treat cancer, which is pancreatic cancer. And in both of these situations, really different types of cancer, the idea of a personalized vaccine, a neoantigen vaccine, has really just, I think, opened up those fields. And so I think that's something in the coming years we have to pay close attention to, because I think that really has potential to change how we sort of think about immunotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about the neoantigens and being unique, that's one of the reasons I got excited with Dr. Amit for the what his concept was, a retired protein. So there was a purpose for that protein in circulation in lactation. So if you were having children, you know, it's I guess relevant of sorts. But then they're looking at proteins or expressions of things that really are retired, that just don't have a use in your body anymore. So that seems obviously in an ideal way, you know, the most favorable, only because, not the most favorable, but one of the favorable ways, because it seems like breast cancers tend to express this lactation protein. But I'm gonna go a little deeper with the questioning on the neoantigen. We've had a few guests like, you know, Thomas Seyfried and Jason Fong. I know those are, you know, radical but necessary conversations at least to have. And that faculty of thinking kind of goes to the fact that cancer is evolutionary. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, polyclonal of sorts, just like COVID has everything from alpha, you know, gamma, omicron, zeta, every Greek letter, and then some. You probably need Mandarin at this point. And then also that they will have different features. So one of the thoughts or criticisms, which, you know, my argument to the criticism would be, well, you need something before everything, is you're kind of chasing a tumor or an expression that has already fostered and now presenting this. And is it going to be a uniform response if you have a, you know, what's called a heterogeneous or yeah, polyclonal of sorts tumor? And of course, the answer is, well, yeah, no, Sanjay, but what you got? You know, like, what is the alternative? And that's going to be a challenge. But as things get faster, and hopefully in the community oncology, you know, it's embarrassing how much I discover the lack of re-biopsy. Like, and yeah, and I mean, even just lab work, just get the circulating tumor DNA, get something, because you know the stuff that disappeared, that now something is new and coming up, is probably not the thing that you had the identity or fingerprint before. You know, it's not that it just shrunk up and came back. It's because it probably has different unique features. So it stresses me out, causes me IBS sometimes about, like, you know, the things that are going to happen and then things are required, but then really what we're still doing years in the past. But it's nonetheless very exciting. Are there some unique properties of renal cell that we are exploring with neoantigens? And
yeah,
what does it require you to produce the vaccine, or can you have like a on the shelf, you know, oh, they have this one and we know most have this one, so let's just, you know, peg it and put it in, kind of almost like off the shelf CAR T, you know, hopes to be one day.
Yeah, no, these are all really interesting points and great questions. So the first is, you know, how do we deal with the problem of, as you said, heterogeneity? Cancer is not just one thing. It's, you know, millions and billions of different cancer cells. They started from one thing, but they evolved over time. And so, you know, the analogy I like to use a lot, and I think a lot of people in genomics sort of use this idea, which is a tree. And you have the trunk of a tree. You have the one cancer cell that started and became two and became four. And then you have the branches, and all those branches end up differently, but they all have a common trunk. So if you can attack the trunk of the tree, you have a much better chance of chopping things down rather than go one branch at a time. And so when we think about this in terms of mutations and neoantigens, the same thing holds true, that we know that the cancer cell has to start as one cell initially. So there are mutations that are clonal or truncal. They're the trunk of the tree. They exist in every single cancer, even though the things have evolved. Every single cancer cell in that patient's body has those truncal mutations. And then there's the ones that are the branches, the subclonal mutations. And so the question is, what do you want to actually attack? Do you want to attack the branches and sort of pare them down over time? And sometimes that's what you have and that's what you got to do. And it still might be helpful in sort of, you know, beating it back a little bit. But ideally, you really want to go after that trunk. And I think that's what we're starting to see in different cancer types, not just kidney, but certainly we're observing that in kidney cancer as well. That when we look at, you know, for instance, the number of neoantigens that a patient has, a patient with kidney cancer, and we say, okay, if they had a lot of neoantigens, maybe they'd respond better to immune therapy. And if they had fewer neoantigens in their tumor, unfortunately, immune therapy might not work so well. And we never really saw that. Yeah, we looked, we studied hundreds and hundreds of tumors. We never really, really saw that. And more recently, we've gone back and said, well, what if we don't look at all mutations? What if we look at the trunk of the tree? And we say, what are the neoantigens formed by the trunk of the tree? And that actually is what made the difference. That is where When we look, the patients who have a lot of those mutations that are clonal, they have a lot of those that are present every cancer cell that are truncal. Those are the patients that, when they get immune therapy, they sometimes not just do well, they do exceptionally well. Those are the patients that when we look at these exceptional responders, that was one of the things that really stood out to us. And so now when we think about how to leverage that, how to use that for a vaccine, that's something that we so can think in our minds, that we can pick mutations that are really hard for the kidney cancer to get rid of. They're the things that are driving it. They're the driver mutations. They're clonal mutations. These are sorts of things that we can sort of factor in as we design a vaccine. The second part is we don't just have to pick one target with a vaccine. And that's one of the things that has changed a lot recently. It's, you know, you're absolutely right. If we pick one thing, we have to really make sure we pick well and it's part of the trunk and not the branch. But also, cancer is constantly evolving. So if we hit one thing, maybe the cancer cell gets rid of that one thing and moves on and, you know, it doesn't work anymore. But I think with technologies, both protein technologies, but a lot with mRNA technologies that have taken off, honestly, largely because of the efforts in the COVID vaccine that really, I think, accelerated the development of mRNA vaccines. You can target not one thing at a time. You can target 20 things at a time, 30 things at a time. And then you have lots more shots on goal to hit those truncal mutations, those truncal changes in the cancer. And it's much harder for the cancer to kind of evolve away from it.
What are some of those truncal mutations? Pardon my ignorance.
No, not at all. So it depends on the cancer type. So for kidney cancer, there's really, and particularly clear cell kidney cancer, which is the most common type. And I should always say kidney cancer is actually a host of different diseases, 20 different diseases. And there's a lot of we just don't understand the biologies of. And we, I think, in a sometimes negative way, sort of lump them together. But the most common type that we know the most about is clear cell. And that is really common truncal mutation. So there's one in VHL gene. This is actually the understanding of how that works both in kidney cancer, but in normal human health is what led to the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2019. It has a key role in how our body senses oxygen. That's almost always goes awry in kidney cancer and clear cell kidney cancer. There's other mutations, certainly, but that's I think a prime example of one of these truncal mutations. Just about every kidney cancer cell would have that. So if we can vaccinate against it, that's a promising target. That's a really good thing to try to attack, because if you can get an immune response against it, it's really hard for the kidney cancer cell to try to evolve its way out of it.
Well, David, if that's the case, please tell me, why isn't there a vaccine against PSA after the prostate's been taken out?
Yeah. Well, I think this goes back to the self versus not self, right? So PSA, it's not that it's not a normal cells. PSA, you know, there are normal prostate cells that make PSA to a low level. And so even if it's a low level, the immune system is, that's what it's trained to do. It's trained to recognize self and non-self. And if it sees itself, even if it's the PSA, that's a hard thing to overcome. It's this idea, that the name for a central tolerance, that our T cells are literally educated to say, don't attack the body. And so if you then have something like PSA, you try to vaccinate, it's not, maybe not conceptually impossible, but you'd have to basically break that central tolerance. You have to try to get the T cells to do what they really hate to do, which is essentially attack self. And that's a much harder thing than to say, attack something that's foreign. That's what the immune system is designed to do.
That's the whole point of the taking off the brakes. But and we've had some really exciting stuff when it comes to prostate. So that patient that had the prostate removed, has a recurrence, has multiple spots, we're finally able to, it almost seems like why did it take so long, you know, go and hone in on that and attack it in targeted therapy kind of ways.
But yeah,
I think that is an example that hopefully can help people appreciate this truncal mutation concept. My question, and again, pardon, you know, my ignorance, but when you're checking molecular testing, which is hopefully, ideally, again, IBS thing, is commonplace across and uniform in stage four community oncology, it's not necessarily, representing the neoantigen, right? So that's the problem.
Yeah.
Like, this is the coding, but is it expressing? So you got to now make that jump. And then what do you do? And how do you, is there just a pan neoantigen test, you know, on circulating not tumor DNA, but neoantigen? So, and then remember, anyone listening, this stuff is like continuing to, I mean, it evolves theoretically, you know, every time of a doubling time. So you're trying to then determine which ones are the ones for what colonies, and some, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, there's a lot of steps, and we've gotten much better at some of them, and we're still pretty lousy at others. And so, you know, when you think back, and we sort of started off with this, right, is the idea of using mechanism, using the lab and science to kind of rationally sort of think things through and having a first principles approach. So if you have a neoantigen, how do you actually get the immune system to respond to it? What makes an effective neoantigen? Well, first you have to have that mutation, something that changes the DNA. That has to get made from, you know, the blueprint, that's the DNA, the actual product protein. But then that protein has to actually go onto the surface of the cell. It has to be presented by the cell for the immune system. And the tools that our cells use to do that, these so-called HLA molecules, they're really, really diverse. And so if you look at just healthy populations, they're probably the most diverse genes we have in our whole genome, these HLA molecules. And so if you have one person, even if two people have the exact same mutation in their tumor, if one person was born in the U.S. and another person was born in Asia, they're very likely to have totally different HLA types. If two people are just in New York, more likely than not, they're going to have different HLA types. And we know that that's true, because sometimes we have difficulties. HLA types is one of the things people look at when they do bone marrow transplants, stem cell transplants, and it's sometimes really hard to find a match because you have to match all of these different HLA genes and they're so different. And so that's something you have to factor in as well, not just what's the specific mutation, but what is that patient's HLA types, and is it actually going to take that mutation and present it to the T cells? So how do you figure that out? You know, the mutations we're pretty good at now, right? We have all of this mutation testing. There's, you know, a lot of commercial companies that work on that do it incredibly well, that they're able to take a tumor, sequence it, and figure out exactly what mutations it has. But how do you figure it out that it's going to actually be presented to the immune system as an antigen? That we still have a lot of work to go, but it's gone a lot better. And it's actually gone a lot better because of machine learning. So as more and more data has come up and more people have studied not just a couple hundred or 1,000 individual little proteins that can be presented on the surface, but hundreds of thousands, that's where you can take fancy neural networks and these sorts of things, actually train it on that sort of data, and now have a much, much better predictor. And that's what groups have done. And it's really improved the ability to predict what's going to be an effective antigen by, I think, you know, really a substantial amount.
I didn't even know we were going to go there, this podcast.
You can't avoid it.
I'm actually on the editorial board of AI and Precision Oncology. I'm obsessed with AI. And, you know, I was going to say Scott Penberth, he was the director of Google AI, pretty much still AI, Google Things. And him and, you know, Leroy Hood are looking at wearables that can kind of dynamically assess things, you know, in real time and just have a storage. Now, this is on a precision level of the individual. Then, like you said, you take processing power of logs greater. That's where the hope comes that I'm trying to explain to people. What, you know, one, if somebody says AI, you think that'll work out? It's like, oh, like, you know, I almost just want to, like, you know, gag, because obviously it's not this, you know, strong AI that you see in movies. It's just even analysis that can be done at such a higher level. That in itself, outside of the science and all the things we've discovered, people forget an accelerator, and a very important one that can be a bottleneck is, can you crunch the stuff to really be able to appreciate the nuances? And I think that's something that's super exciting, and one can conceive, at least, you know, having a device that, instead of drawing the lab, taking it off, sending it, so, you know, wherever it needs to go, and then it's being dynamic, if you could just conceive that there could be an evaluation in a device inside where your blood is running through all the time, you know, that is a distant future kind of thought.
Yeah.
To be able to do some things in real time, and you know, you could take it all sci-fi from there. Can you engineer, you know, this coding through the device itself to just start deploying? But before we go, you know, I guess to, I hope one day, but not
the
near,
speed at which things are moving. It's, you know, it's, you know, things that would seem crazy 10 years ago, look at where we are today. So I think, you know, I think people want to, there's a good element of being practical and looking at what's in front of you. But I think, you know, to make big advances, you also have to kind of look big and think big sometimes. So I think,
yeah,
you know, brainstorming and seeing where would we like to end up and how do we get there is not a bad thing at all.
And I mean, we have so much data that, like, we just don't have the hands and the brains to dissect it. I mean, unfortunately, people have had cancer for a long time, and they've had documentation and electronic medical records for a long time. So this is a way to take what we already know and, you know, like the difficulties and the sadness and the tears of people passing and when we thought things would work, and really be able to crunch it in many different ways. Another, you know, exciting thought is the vaccination now in a preventative way for the neoantigens you're talking about. So imagine that we have identified enough that we can say, this really doesn't seem expressed, you know, in the human body when it's reached a certain XYZ point, and even potentially neoantigens for the pre-cancer, you know, cellular level. So the things that we know may be expressed the same way we take out a tubulovillous adenoma because we're like, oh, this looks sketchier than a normal adenoma, you know, the same way that it has features that we see under, you know, a microscope in tissue. Yeah. Presumably, there are things that are occurring to make that tissue appear that way that we know are abnormal. And if we can isolate those things and have vaccinations to be able to present even at pre-cancer stage, that would be pretty exciting.
No, I think absolutely. And the idea, we've talked about, you know, therapeutic vaccines, but the idea of something preventive, I think at a population level, that's where you have the chance to make really big, big gains. And I think, you know, people don't think of it as a cancer vaccine necessarily, but the HPV vaccine definitely falls into that bucket, right? It's not a fancy neoantigen. We're not doing high-powered sequencing and those sorts of things, but that's what it is. It's a we know those HPV serotypes are, you know, really horrific causes of cervical cancer, more and more things like, you know, head and neck cancer, anal cancer, and the idea of widespread vaccination, a preventive vaccine, has been, I think, transformative for a large group of the population, large swath of the population. Now, can we actually now take that to sort of a different level? That's, you know, virally driven cancer. What if we could actually try to do that for non-virally driven cancer, something that's driven by mutations? I think this challenge is that a lot of people will sort of point to that, you know, a lot of mutations that a tumor has, they're unique to each patient. So if I have two patients with kidney cancer, overwhelming likelihood is that none of their mutations will be the same. And that's going to be true for kidney cancer and a whole host of cancers. But there's other common tumor types where it really, people do share mutations. You know, patients with pancreatic cancer overwhelmingly have mutations in this one gene called KRAS. There's many other examples where there's really a gene that gets turned on and it's the driver of the cancer. And so, you know, again, it's sort of, it's far in the future, but thinking, can we actually leverage that in some sort of preventive way, I think is really an exciting, at least thought experiment. And I think we have a lot of work to go where, you know, right now the therapy is the thing that's right in front of us because it has kind of the most immediate, you know, we kind of know whether it's working pretty quickly. But I think ultimately it's important to think big like that and think about, okay, can we take that from something that's affecting people who already have cancer to actually think about how we can maybe prevent it in the first place?
100%. David, I'm going to ask you two questions that I've never asked anybody, you know, point blank, because I'm nervous. They're both kind of overwhelming. The first one is really a pulling back, and I don't know why I didn't think to do this. But I just needed the right person, the brilliant person in front of me. Why can you, what is your guess as to why these cancer rates are just getting earlier and, you know, more frequent? You know, before we would say, oh, we have better screening and we're picking it up more and people are getting more care. But there's still, outside of that, you know, a concern that the rates are getting younger and the diagnoses are more frequent. What is your take on that?
Yeah, it's a really important question because we see more and more of these really devastating situations of young people, you know, just starting off their lives, just, you know, young families, and they're affected with these horrible and aggressive cancers, colorectal cancer, many others. And I think you're right. You know, part of the answer is going to be the low-hanging fruit of we have better screening. We can pick these things up and, you know, something that might have been there, you know, for 10 years and being picked up in someone's 50s or 60s now, it's being picked up in their 40s or earlier. There's more widespread screening for breast cancer and colon cancer and these sorts of things. And so I think that's part of it. But there's clearly a missing piece. And I don't think we know the answer, right? You know, I think there's a lot of speculation one could do. I think certainly people have thought about things like diet. People have thought a lot about metabolism and how people's metabolisms have really been altered. We know that, you know, we know that the diet we have that can affect the bacteria that live within us, the microbiome, that affects our metabolism. That really has a clear interaction with cancer.
and immune system.
Absolutely. Oh, you're spot on with that. We know even actually those microbiome components that live within our gut, they can even influence how well someone responds to something like an immune therapy. But no one has honed in on the factor or the group of factors. So I think these are all really important hypotheses, but now really, I think, critical to sort of hone down, okay, what is the actual thing that's doing it, the group of things that are doing it? Because maybe those are things we could modulate, right? If it's some element of diet, some altered metabolism, those are maybe things we can begin to think about how to rationally address. But you know, in my mind, I always go back to first principles, understanding it first, getting your foundation, and then kind of trying to rationally figure out from there. And I think that's a concerted effort that is needed here too.
100%. Yeah, it's, you can get out into some slippery rabbit holes, you know, where, gosh, I mean, I was pressed pretty hard on a podcast I did, and there was just like, well, now tell me. I mean, they were just getting so granular about everything. Like, I hear dairy is terrible, and you know,
yeah.
And I think that is the last thing we'd be able to achieve. Really, it's behavioral stuff that you can kind of try to isolate. What are we doing now? What do our lives look like now? And what were they 30 years ago? And some things are pretty inarguable. You know, the heterogeneity or variability of the things we put in our bodies were so much more dynamic then, right? And a lot of people consider that, you know, a good kind of workout for your immune system and exposure, and much like allergies that people get if they're just always using hand sanitizer versus being out there, you know, in the soil. The same principle rides there. Of course, Jason Fung, you know, highlights the fact that the insulin spikes are just so much higher. It's not even just having diabetes.
Yeah.
It's just taking this growth factor that's insulin and just subjecting, you know, at 8,000 RPMs, you know, on your car repeatedly that may even bite things. So that part's challenging. So that's, I love that you mentioned really the two or three things that I think are the things we need to examine very closely, you know, up front. My second question, I don't know why I haven't thought about doing this either, but again, I just love the way you think about everything. And I get this question all the time, as you can imagine, on social media and the like. I don't like the term, and the book I was writing, and now it's just been on a sabbatical itself, and I don't know if I'll ever get to it, but the title was, "It's Time to Cancel the Term A Cure for Cancer," and it has a strike through, because I don't believe there will be a cure for cancer, and I think most people will agree with that. But if there is conceivably, like, so forget metabolic for a second and preventing it and those things. What does a potential curative setting for malignancies look like? And I'm just going to give you a lead.
Yeah.
I know it's probably going to be multimodality.
Yep.
It's going to be multi-mechanistic for a lot of the reasons we mentioned. There's different ways and strategies you can find those Achilles heel. But what do you conceive? One, do you think it'll be in you and my lifetime? You must be older than me because of all the degrees you have, but you look like you're younger than me. And then two, like, is it going to happen in our lifetime? And then three, what is it going to look like? Because Sid Mukherjee is big on saying it's going to be multi-mechanistic. And he said the sequencing of those things are very important.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear your answer.
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question. And I think it's going to be, again, a couple of principles together. So you mentioned this idea of multimodal of different types of treatments. I think that's true to some extent. But I think it, to me, one of the key things is probably going to be combinations of things. And this is not, it's actually an old idea, not a new idea. It's the basic idea that started a lot of systemic therapy for cancer. It started chemotherapy that, if we go back to the history, originally it was one drug, right? It was Sidney Farber giving this folate antagonist, aminopterin. And then that worked for a transient amount, you know, time. It worked for a bit, but it never cured anyone. And then the first things that actually cured someone is when you started to combine chemotherapies together. And the principle behind that is actually, it's not that complicated. It's math. It's you have a drug that's 99% effective. That's 99.9% effective. That's a great drug, right? It's going to kill 99.9% of tumor cells. Well, if you have a billion tumor cells and you kill 99.9%, you still have a million tumor cells left over. And those million tumor cells that are resistant are going to keep growing and they'll eventually take over and they'll come back. But if you have a second drug and that second drug is 99.9% effective too, and it works in a totally different way, now the numbers begin to work in your favor. They multiply together. So you don't have a million cells left over, you only have 1,000 cells left over. Add a third drug, and now you go from 1,000 cells left to only one cell left. And you can imagine, you keep doing the math, And eventually the numbers work in your favor, that you combine things enough and the numbers get small enough where you can actually think about not just reducing the number of cancer cells, but getting rid of them altogether. And so when I think about multimodal therapy, that's one of the principles in my mind, using those numbers to your favor. The second is the type of therapy. And this is where I have my own biases. I see patients with kidney cancer, but a big part of my life is I run a cancer immunology lab. And I really think immunotherapy holds that potential because it's not just the way it works is so fundamentally different. It's not attacking the cancer cell. It's waking up your own immune system to do what it's supposed to do, to basically do its job, which is to attack something that's foreign, to try to get rid of it, and to build a long-lasting memory so that if it ever encounters that thing again, it knows what to do. That's what the immune system is trained for, you know, tens of thousands of years longer to be able to do. And so leveraging that, making use of that to have a long-standing, whether it's, you know, trying to get to a cure or term we sometimes use is long-term control. You know, that patient who got IL-2 was 20 years later, no one can say for sure that patient is cured, but I think I would take 20, 30, 40 years. You're in a good situation then. And having that long-term immune control is something I think is different about immune therapies than about chemotherapy, about targeted therapy. It's something unique to that group of immune therapies. And so I think one thing will be combinations, using the numbers to your favor, but the second is really leaning in on immune therapy. Where I always think of it right now as the proof of concept phase, that with the tools that we have, we can show that for a small set of patients, they can do not just, you know, well for a short amount of time. It's not just improving quality of life, which is really important, or improving length of life by months or a year or two. Again, really, really important, but it's actually really getting rid of the cancer, at least that we can see with our eyes, and doing so for year after year after year. But that's not everyone. That's not the majority of people. That's unfortunately still a really small fraction. And so I think we use that proof of concept and we build on it and we say, let's leverage the immune system as much as we can to try to get rid of it.
Yeah, I love the word, you know, durable response or durability. Yep. And so, you know, similarly of the same concept and in multimodality, you know, I guess I partly meant combination.
Yeah.
It's multi-mechanistic.
Yeah.
You know, the thought in general for me is reduce that mutational variability as fast as possible. You have a billion, bring it down a million. So multiple chemos. That's why I don't think chemo will ever go away, because it's just your shotgun to immediately reduce. But it has a half-life, like you said.
Yeah.
And then when it's flushed out, But then, you know, you use that, or you can inject it in the tumor, and then this antigen presentation, you can kind of unlock or break the seal open to present all of these antigens we talked about at the beginning of this podcast. Then you drip in the immune therapy to say, yo, go find these posters, go see what these unusual suspects look like. I just presented them all to you. Now you got your snipers, you know, at hand. And then, you know, if there is some targeted therapy in there that for the stuff that's left over from the cytotoxic, you know, you can do actionable mutations. And then I think, you know, the newer thing we're considering is, and then on top of that, have some window of time where if you could have this concept of starving, which it sounds a little, I think, over-optimistic, but, you know, eliminate its fuel sources and then sprinkle less chemo. So you're killing it and also not giving it sustainability, you know, with amino acid deprivation is popular these days and these other things. I think it's going to be a sequencing of kind of, you know, the same way you do a bone marrow transplant. But here it's like this is going to be what our, you know, 4 to 6 month plan is, rather than what we do now is let's just kind of keep it going until it stops working and then do something new. I think that's the way, but that's where I think AI and this data crunching will really help us get there sooner rather than having to, you know, trial and error. Of course, that'll always be around, but at least to be able to see, what if we did it this way and this way? So, you know, it's exciting and I'm glad we're both part of it.
No, you're completely right. And, you know, part of it is you go back to what works. I go back to this, again, this example of pediatric leukemias, but that's exactly right. Figure out what were the combinations, what were the sequencing of, you know, what do you hit it with first? What do you hit with second? Induction, you know, consolidation. And that's what really led to these long-term responses, you know, these cures in so many kids, was the hard work of figuring that out. And at that time, it was all empiricism. It was trying one thing at a time, having a little rationale, but trying one thing at a time and seeing what worked. But now I think that we have tools like AI, being able to try to make use of that to do this in a little bit more of an informed way, I think is a really exciting possibility for the years to come.
100%. David, this was a true pleasure. This very enjoyable.
Pleasure's all mine. Really, this is great.
Your enthusiasm, your passion, I think is extremely unique and the way you explain it. So where can people find you? You have anything else you want to leave us with or an anecdote or seed to chew on?
Yeah. So again, I'm in the academic realm, you know, the halls of Yale. So I see patients there. I run a lab there. And the big thing is I'm always looking for smart people and good ideas. So anytime we can have a good conversation, if people are scientists, they want to think about how to solve some of these problems together. I'm definitely less of a social media expert, but, you know, trying to at least be on X and these sorts of things, and happy to talk to, happy to have conversations. And yeah, I think as a community, we can hopefully do a good job of trying to push things forward.
100%. Think tank, you know, ship is where it's at. And we'll get Pedro Barato one day and get us all together, because he will bring all kinds of color into this conversation.
That'd be perfect.
That's it. Thank you so much, David. It's been a true pleasure.